The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Catherine Pompilio with an episode from the Lawfare Archive for March 6, 2022. We're now a week into Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Amidst coverage of the fighting and guessing what Russia's next move will be, there seems to be a lot of questions about Russian President Vladimir Putin. Why did he do this? Is he mentally sane? Who is Vladimir Putin really, and what does he want? To give some insight into these questions, I chose an archive episode from December 2017. In the episode, Alina Polyakova talked to Mikhail Zigar, a Russian independent journalist and the author of two books on the Kremlin's elite circle. They discussed why Putin may be far from a strategic mastermind and what it's really like to be close to Vladimir Putin.
I'm Alina Polyakova, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 9th, 2017. Just last month, the U.S. Department of Justice required RT, the Kremlin-funded propaganda news outlet, to register as a foreign agent. In response, the Russian government passed a law cracking down on Western media operating in Russia. For this episode of Lawfare's special Russia series, I talked to Mikhail Zigar, who's a Russian independent journalist, filmmaker, and author of two books on the Kremlin's elite circle. Misha tells us what it's like to be an independent journalist in Putin's Russia and why he thinks Putin is far from a strategic mastermind. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 267, Mikhail Zigar on Putin as the accidental king.
So, Misha, I wanted to ask you to do this podcast for a variety of reasons. One is you are, I think, a well-known independent journalist, writer, filmmaker. You're one of the founding editor-in-chiefs of the independent Russian television channel TV Dozhd or TV Rain. And you were there, I think, in a really interesting and critical time in development of Russia under Putin. That was from 2011, 2015. Of course, this is when the intervention in Ukraine happened, the occupation of Crimea, the invasion of the Donbass. And Dozhd was, I think, one of the only, if not the only, television channel that was reporting on some of these issues. And, you know, right now in Washington, there's a lot of more attention to the situation for independent media in Russia. RT, the Kremlin-funded television channel that broadcasts in the United States, registered as a foreign agent, complying with the Department of Justice request to do so in November. And as a result, there's been a lot of fear among journalists, among Russia observers, that there's going to be retaliation in Russia against independent media, Western media, but also Russian media. Given all the years you spent, you know, working in Russia, reporting a different point of view than what the Russian state media reports, I wanted to start by getting your sense of, you know, what is it really like to be an independent journalist in Russia today? What was it like during your years?
That's a very good question. And it seems to me that actually the dangers of being an independent journalist in Russia is usually overestimated or exaggerated in Western media. Actually, you can be independent journalist in Russia. That's possible. We have a lot of independent journalists, but each of them has an alternative. He or she has to choose if he wants or she wants to be an independent media, independent journalist, and that means that he or she will not be successful, will not be rich, and they are going to be miserable, because that's the only option for Russian media market, that any independent media cannot be successful and profitable. So that's under that condition, we have a lot of independent news websites. We have some even radio stations. We used to have one independent TV channel called Dorst, which founding editor-in-chief I was. Now it's much more a fee-paid news website, but it still exists. That tradition of independent media outlets, independent newspapers or TV channels not being able to remain successful, to remain sustainable, is a long tradition, and that's the way how the system usually puts pressure on independent media. Independent media cannot have commercial partners; they cannot earn any money from advertisers, so they have to be very poor. Sometimes they have to stop their activities because of lack of any money. But at the same time, that that economic situation helps Russian new media to try to develop and try to flourish. In that sense, online media, social media are much more developed in Russia than probably in many countries of the world. That looks like a global trend, that traditional newspapers or traditional broadcast TV channels are slowly dying everywhere in the world, except for Russia, because in Russia all the real independent newspapers or broadcast TV channels are already dead. And the only quality media in Russia are always online. Sometimes these are like investigative bloggers or some very little private independent media, but they are managing to continue very important investigations, to publish very important articles, researches, and so on. That's the only way for Russian journalists to be independent.
I take your point that the picture is much more over exaggerated than it is in reality, meaning that there is, of course, an independent media in Russia today. I read it, many people read it, but it does seem like the situation mm-hmm. is getting much worse, and it seems like it's going beyond the regime's limits on the funding, the resources that you're talking about that independent media can have access to, which of course limits their ability to reach broader audiences because of course you need money for that. But it does seem that more and more, you know, on a monthly basis now, we're hearing reports of attacks on journalists who are reporting on issues in a way that is not in line with the government's view of the world.
Totally agree with you when you're saying that the situation is getting worse, and that's true. Let's say about 3 years ago, TV Rain, the TV channel I used to run, had 20 million viewers per day. Or we had another very important media holding called RBK. That was also a very important news corporation and very independent. And now TV Rain is just a little website beyond the paywall with only 70,000 subscribers. And the whole editorial team of RBK had to leave that media, and the whole team was replaced by other people, and the whole editorial policy has changed. So yes, you are right. The situation is becoming worse and worse. And when now I'm saying that the only quality investigations could turn up on the internet, that's the reality that is quite new for our country. I'm sorry for interrupting you, because I could not agree with the fact that we are facing a lot of threats or independent journalists are in danger because of their reporting. We had a very outrageous attack on Tatiana Filgenhauer.
Could you say a few words about who Tatiana is for our listeners who may not know?
I will, sure. She's a news anchor, and she is an anchor of a morning show of radio station Echo of Moscow. This radio station is famous for being one of the most independent and probably the only one independent or approximately independent radio station. And Tatiana is deputy editor-in-chief, and she is one of the most famous reporters of that of that radio. So that was a really first attack against her. She was attacked by a man who is supposed to be mentally insane. We don't know anything about the real reasons of that attack. We know that Tatiana suspects that he was not actually insane, but he was pretending. We still don't know, but normally I usually say that in Russia journalists are no more threatened than, like, I don't know, plumbers. The situation is not that different for different people. Any one of us could be attacked any day, but normally we're safe. We know that Russian judiciary system and Russian police and prison system is the major threat to anyone living in Russia. We're not facing direct threats from unknown criminals or from some unknown government-related structures. We know that we are quite vulnerable, and any one of us could be accused of anything, and we are rather fragile in front of Russian police or Russian judiciary system, because none of us believes in free and or independent judiciary system, and we and much more journalists are suffering because they have been accused of some crimes no one believes they have committed. So I mean not physical attacks, but I would say psychological attacks, or those unfair trials are much more much bigger threat to Russian journalism. And just returning to the first question about if Russian authorities could respond to the registration of RT as a foreign agent in the US, and if there could be any revenge for Russian independent media, actually I'm afraid yes, because the first thing they have started talking about was some restrictions of internet, and internet is exactly the platform for all the independent media, all the independent investigative journalists who are trying to work as bloggers or as a lot of new media which are turning up in Russia. So definitely that is the last stronghold of media freedom in Russia.
So I think that's something that hasn't been discussed that much, is that this new quote-unquote retaliatory law that President Putin signed on November 25th actually greatly expanded the government's mandate to be able to limit content that is published not just in print, but increasingly more online in the digital space. And this has been part of, what has been a long-term strategy to try to control what is published in the online space and try to control access to the online space by the Kremlin that's been going on for a very long time. So I think, you know, the point that you're making, though, is that even though independent Russian journalists may not face more threats than your average, you know, Russian citizen from the secret services or the state police or other administrative bodies of the Russian government, the situation in terms of the clampdown on independent media's ability to function is getting much worse. So my question to you is, you know, given that the state-run media dominate the information space in Russia, what is the regime really afraid of as they seek to limit the ability of independent media to do their work in print and online?
I don't think that they are really afraid. I think the word afraid is not really proper, because they're quite self-confident, and they really think that that they are okay. That's much more a habit, but that's much more a tradition that they always want to adjust the system. They always want to make their lives more comfortable. That's not part of the strategy. For example, in my previous book, All the Kremlin's Men, I described that for President Putin and his inner circle and Kremlin administration, there are no long-term strategies. They never have that. They don't have a strategy for Russian economic situation. They don't have a strategy for foreign policy. They don't have any strategy for Russian media. Do we believe that they have a plan how to put pressure on the independent media, and what amount of independent journalists should be tolerated in Russia or not? No, they don't have any plan at all. They don't have even a bureaucrat in Kremlin who is in charge of the media, because normally they have four, at least four, very high-ranking top-level bureaucrats in Kremlin. All of them are officially named deputy chief of staff of Kremlin, or first deputy chief of staff. They are absolutely independent from one another. They are always competing one another. They are always trying to prove to President Putin that each of them is more effective than another one. There are a lot of intrigues between all these bureaucrats, and they are trying to invent the new rules, the new amendments, the new sanctions against media. Sometimes they are trying to pretend that they are liberal, or at least more liberal than others, and then they are trying to protect liberal media. The next day they're trying to prove that they are the most loyal to President Putin. So that's, you know, that's a mixture of different interests, of different businessmen, of different politicians, of different bureaucrats, and actually that's not one single strategy what to do with independent media. Putin is usually very reactive. He's not a strategic player, he's a tactical player.
And this is a big debate among the Russia watchers in the West as well. You know, is Putin a tactician or a strategist? I think the debate is a little moot. I take your point, and I think I agree with you, that it is a series of reactive tactics driven by competition among the elite to curry favor with Putin and to present him with ideas that will satisfy him when it comes specifically to the media space, but pretty much all other issues as well. But can't a series of short-term thinking tactics over the years add up to what looks like a much broader repression strategy?
Yes, definitely. And that's how we've come to the situation where we know. In the beginning of his first presidential term, Putin didn't want and didn't play to bring us into that desert. That was like, you know, step by step, bit by bit, and as a result of all those intrigues between his assistants, we are in that terrible situation we are in now. At the same time, definitely, the new strategy or the new attempt to create a strategy or long-term tactical plan for his next presidential term should be determined right after the presidential elections. At least we hear those talks now in Russia, and definitely after March, they have to try to create some kind of plan. What should they do next? Which part of Russian population should they focus on? Which ideology should they use as their main message to Russian people? So probably after the presidential election, pressure against free internet and independent media could become even more, because actually I'm afraid it will be.
So you mentioned your book already, and I wanted to go back to talk a little bit about that. You know, all the Kremlin's Men, your first book, Inside the Court of Vladimir Putin, published in 2015, became a bestseller in Russia. Has been translated into English. I think what's very interesting about the book that you started talking about is how you frame decision-making that has happened or has developed under Putin since he came to power. You refer to Putin as an accidental king. Can you explain just very briefly why you see him as this, you know, accidental leader, not someone who has strategically, I suppose, come to power, maintain power? Why is he the accidental king?
You know, first of all, he has never been a politician, and he has never wanted to be one, and he has never planned to become Russian president. That was not his choice. That looks like a legend, but I suspect that it's true. That the first time he was offered the position of Yeltsin's successor, he answered that he would like to become the CEO of Gazprom, Russian state-owned natural gas corporation. That was not his choice. He was offered to be a presidential candidate, to be a prime minister, to be the next Russian president after Boris Yeltsin. And in the beginning, after he accepted that proposal, he didn't have his own strategy. He didn't have his own agenda. And his agenda of his first presidential term was not his idea, but that was an idea, that was an agenda of the team that made him presidential candidate. In the beginning, thanks to that agenda and thanks to those people who formed his inner circle, he seemed to be and actually he was probably very reform oriented. He was one of the most pro-Western leaders in Russian history. A short example: he was the only Russian leader to propose Russia joining NATO, and he was even discussing that with George W. Bush and Lord George Robertson at that time, Secretary General of NATO. In the beginning, Putin really wanted to implement some a bit painful but very bold liberal economic reforms. Unfortunately, all those reforms stopped in the first 3 years of his first presidential term. There were different reasons for Putin to change his mind during the very first presidential term. Different reasons for stopping the reforms, and the major reason was that the economic situation was okay even without all those painful reforms, because the oil prices started rocketing, and no one needed actually all those reforms. The situation became very successful and prosperous even without them. He stopped being very pro-Western, because first he wanted to make friends with his Western partners as George W. Bush or Tony Blair. Then he felt that he's not really respected, and he's not treated as an equal partner. And he was very insulted by that. That was a very personal approach, and actually he usually uses that personal approach in international relationships. He was offended by NATO enlargement. He was offended of not being invited to join Iraqi operation. Then he started being paranoid because of a lot of people from his inner circle telling him that there was some American-led conspiracy against him. He started believing in that global conspiracy. He started believing that the real aim of Bush doctrine was a regime change in Russia. He started believing that America really wants to overthrow him. And actually, he changed most of his principles he seemed to believe in the beginning of his first presidential term. That's what I mean, that he has become a really accidental president, accidental leader, promoting those values that were not his true values when he was chosen to be Yeltsin's successor.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
You talk about this transformation of Putin from his early terms. You call him Putin the Lionhearted, who believed, or at least said to have believed, the power of actual real economic reforms that all failed for various reasons. And then this other change that comes in him, where he eventually, because of the paranoia you describe, the emotional response, the taking personally these political, geopolitical outcomes, decisions made by the UK, the United States in the early 2000s, that he transforms into what he is now, which is Putin the Terrible, as we call him. I think what keeps coming out in all the conversations we have about, you know, who is Putin really? You know, none of us really know. You may know the best because you did an amazing number of interviews for this book with the inner circle around Putin. And I wanted to get a sense from you, you know, one, what was it like to talk to all of these power brokers within the Kremlin? You know, were they open? Did you get the sense they were open to having a conversation with you? You know, how did you even get them to talk to you in the first place? And were you surprised that so many were willing to talk to you about these dealings within the court, if you want to call it that?
That's a question I'm always asked. And first, You probably will believe me, that's a thing that almost everyone knows in Russia, but almost no one knows outside of Russia. The majority of Putin's inner circle is very pro-Western and very liberally minded. something like 99% of our government, of the people who are supposed to be in charge of Russian politics, in terms of political liberalism mainly, and they are very pro free market, pro capitalism, not in American meaning of liberalism. Russian version of liberalism usually means pro democracy and being anti anti communism and anti authoritarianism at the same time.
Wait, Misha, I have to ask you then. So you said that 99% of those elite close to the Russian government or part of the Russian government would consider themselves liberal, even liberal in the sense of pro-democratic, even though Russia is not a democracy in the way that at least democracy is understood to be in Western countries.
That's a paradox, exactly. I would say that they are much more pro-West than pro-democratic. You know, I've heard so many times from them the same mantra that, yeah, definitely we want Russia to be a democratic country. But, you know, Russia is not ready for it. We have to wait. The situation is so very unstable so far. Our enemies are so aggressive. The economic crisis is so dangerous, so we have to wait for at least 10 or better 20 years so to stabilize the internal situation. And probably in 10 or 20 years, Russia is going to be much more ready for free elections, for free media, for a really independent judicial system, and so on and so on. Unfortunately, I'm hearing that nonsense for many years, and sometimes it seems that some people really believe in that. Sometimes people from the government or from Kremlin administration understand that that's just an excuse, that's just a cynical talk of professional politician. But still, all of them or most of them are very pro-Western. Most of them care about their reputation. None of them believes that they are some evil doers. None of them think that they could be considered to be Dr. Evil or corrupted, cynical politician. And all of them want to have their reputation much cleaner than they can, and even more, they want to be remembered as crystal clear statesmen in Russian history.
So, I mean, it sounds like what's interesting in what you're describing is two things. One is that all of this talk that eventually at some point Russia could be ready to be a democratic country once we really stabilize the economic system and the political system. But that in a way, this talk is also used as an excuse to justify a much more, you know, controlled, expansive state apparatus that has come to be under the current regime.
At the same time, a lot of people from Putin's inner circle do not dare to give him any advice because they know that they are tolerated only because they do not criticize him and they do not annoy him with their own initiatives. They're answering his questions. They are fulfilling his demands. They are trying to be as professional as they could and understand their limits and watch their limits. So a lot of those politically liberally minded pro-reform bureaucrats are very careful about not speaking their minds.
But I think, you know, that also points to the second, I think, trend that you're describing, that there is still hope that even among the Russian elite, which I think in the West tend to be seen as pro-Putin, anti-democratic, so the opposite of what you're describing, anti-liberal, anti-Western. But you're saying that, no, actually, there is still a group within the elite that at least like to think of themselves as a pro-Western liberal, bureaucrats, party officials, government officials, and that, you know, they're in a certain kind of system where they're fearful, anxious, because they don't want to displease the Kremlin or Putin himself, but that, you know, maybe there's still hope that there could, if there is political change in Russia, there could be an individual or a set of individuals that come to power at some point that could actually usher in a more, I guess, open, democratic, liberal era to follow Putin whenever that moment comes.
Oh, you know, I really think that's a meaningless speculation, because unfortunately we have to always ask ourselves what's going to happen after Putin. That was the question I was asking all of them, mostly those pro-Western members of Putin's in his circle, but there are hawkish guys as well, and I cannot consider them to be pro-Western. And most of them gave me approximately the same answer, and it was like, you know, that's such a scary question. What's going to happen next after Putin? So I cannot think about that. That's the major factor of instability in Russia. Actually, current stability itself is the major factor of instability. That we don't have any political institutions that can guarantee that that any transition of power is going to be safe and peaceful and effective, because we don't know any scenario of that transition. The key message of Putin's propaganda is that, and actually that's unfortunately is that Putin believes in. He believes in that he is the only one capable to run the country. He's the only one who's able to keep it stable. And his inner circle are not thinking of that scenario of who is going to come next. They usually trying to explain that the current stability is better than an unexpected and unpredictable democracy. They always say that even within Putin's inner circle, there are a lot of different decent pro-reform bureaucrats, or even not in inner circle, but there are some of his old friends, like, for example, Alexei Kudrin, who used to be his former prime minister, former minister of finances, and he's rumored that he's got chances to become probably next prime minister after the next presidential election. And that's going to be the best scenario of Russian liberalization from above.
As background for our listeners, Kudrin is known to be a reform-oriented individual who has been close to Putin for a long time, serving various roles, highest role as the finance minister at one point under Putin, and who's been tasked with proposing an economic reform agenda to the Kremlin. But so far, we haven't seen a great deal of what that actually will mean going forward.
I must add that for last like 5 years, Kudrin is in the opposition, and he is criticizing, if not Putin personally, but at least the system and the corruption, and Kudrin looks like an allowed opposition. He could be considered to be a decent person within today's Russian political landscape, with only one important detail that we all know that he's still rather close to President Putin, and he will not ever challenge him. He will not run for presidency against Putin. He would not attack Putin personally. He would not go to any protest rally without informing Putin about that.
So I want to spend a few minutes highlighting the fact that you, even though you're very young, you have now published a second book. So you've been doing a lot of amazing things in your career already. And the second book is just out. And it's called, has the very dramatic title of The Empire Must Die. But it's not a book about contemporary Russian politics. It's really a look inside Russia as it was leading up to the revolution of 1917. And, you know, I just want to get a sense from you. You wrote this wonderful book, All the Kremlin's Men. That was this deep look into the decision-making process of the Kremlin today. And then you switch to this more historical account of Russia in the revolutionary days. And do you see, you know, what drove you to switch from contemporary to historical? And as you were writing the book, did you see a lot of similarities or not between where Russia was then at the turn of the 20th century and to what Russia is today at the turn of the 21st century?
Yeah, you know, probably the most important mission for me was to try to create some another angle of Russian Revolution of 1917 and try to write a history of Russian civil society, not history of Russian authorities, because usually all traditional versions of Russian history are very focused on the authorities and Russian leaders, and Russian society doesn't have any obvious examples of what their predecessors were thinking of and how they were influencing the situation. And actually, the beginning of 20th century was probably the period when Russian civil society was booming. Actually, Russian Revolution of 1917 was initiated by Russian civil society. That was the moment when Russian society was the most influential culturally, politically, economically. Russian autocracy collapsed because it was ineffective and corrupted and bureaucratic. And at the same time, Russian civil society was very active. The book is about the people. It does have a lot of similarities with our today's Russia. One of them, a very important one, is that 100 years ago, there was a huge conflict between Russian authorities and Russian civil society. And there was a great level of mutual distrust. And Russian authorities, including the emperor and his family, could not believe that the opposition leaders could be sincere. They always had, not only imperial family, but the bureaucracy thought that all the critics of the regime might be spies or traitors or might have been bribed by the security agencies or intelligence services and so on. That prejudice against the opposition within Russian bureaucracy is a never-ending tradition. And that's what we hear now, and how corruption works as the factor stabilizing Russian bureaucracy is very interesting fact. It worked to unify Russian bureaucracy 100 years ago as well,
and it continues to do that now under Putin.
Yeah. It's even much more important than it was 100 years ago. At the same time, you know, Russia 100 years ago was probably, or Russian society at least, was a bit more democratic, because by that time we had something like 50 years after the independent judiciary was established by the Emperor Alexander II, something like 50 years after the free and fair local elections were established. So the civil society was very very certain of its rights and of its possibilities to influence the situation. Russian big business was very ambitious in its attempts to change the political system.
Given the similarities you're describing, yes or no question before I let you go. You know, the empire collapses in Russia 100 years ago. Do you see a similar collapse in Russia's future today?
No, it's not going to happen soon. I hope it's not going to be that tragic as it happened 100 years ago, because the collapse of that empire could be absolutely different. The Bolshevik Revolution was not the only option. So I hope the end of current regime is going to be, I hope, much more peaceful and would lead to much more democratic Russia than it happened 100 years ago. But I definitely see that the autocratic system in our country is not sustainable.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to tweet the Lawfare podcast, share it on Facebook, ВКонтакте, and give it a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution system you may use. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. I'm Alina Polyakova. Thanks for listening. Is it Yan or Yan?
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.